Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
The word transgender is relatively new. It first appeared in an academic paper in the 1960s. Now, if you're like me and you grew up in the baby boomer generation, there's a pretty good chance that you did not know anything about what trans or transgender is or what it means. And why would you? It wasn't a part of your everyday life and it wasn't openly discussed. But here on Conversations That Matter, that serves as an invitation to learn more about our ever-changing world. Now, with the recent enactment of Bill C-16 here in Canada, which ensures that transgendered people are guaranteed the same human rights as those who identify, like me, with the gender I was assigned at birth, it seemed to be a perfect time to sit down with transgender activist and author Lisa Salazar for a conversation that matters. Lisa Salazar, welcome to Conversations That Matter. By the time this airs, we're a few days beyond the enactment of Bill C-16 into Parliament, into law, which gives full human rights to people who are transgender.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to talk about today. What does it mean to be transgender? What exactly is transgender? And how do those of us who want to know more come to understand what that experience is like for somebody who is living that journey? You've lived that journey.
Yes.
How important is, let's start with how important Bill C-16 is.
The legislation is really important because it becomes the basis of being able to educate society. I think one of the pushbacks against enacting the bill was the argument that we already have all the protection that we need under the charter, under the category of sex. That may be so, technically speaking. And many human rights tribunals have agreed with that, including in BC. The problem is that when the language is not explicit, then you always have to argue, make the same arguments over and over again, and then you will hear the same counter arguments from those who are defending their position.
Because it protects people against discrimination.
Against discrimination,
primarily,
yes.
Right? Yes.
And it spells it out on the basis of gender identity and gender expression. Without those phrases or those words in there, we have to argue that we're being discriminated on the basis of sex. And that doesn't always convince everybody. And so it's really important to have clear and explicit language, not just because now the courts and everybody, and human resource departments and corporations and institutions have clear language that they can employ in their own policies.
Mm-hmm.
But it helps little by little to educate society. Because the fact is that just because you pass a law doesn't mean everybody's gonna respect it. And it's really important to not just say gender identity, but also gender expression, because the reality is that many people who are on the transgender spectrum, almost one third of them fall into the category or self-identify as non-binary, which is a relatively recent term that's being used and employed by people to define who they are, because they are challenging the society's binary normality of it's either male, masculine males, and feminine females. So now we're having a conversation, a wider conversation, a much more open conversation, where people who are struggling to figure out how they fit in this binary world, they're saying, well, I'm neither,
yeah,
or I'm both.
Right. Well, you mentioned something that I find interesting, and I think that helps us to define what it means to be trans, because you said on the trans spectrum.
Yes.
What is that spectrum? How do we define it from one side to the next?
That's right. What needs to be understood, too, is that the word transgender is a relatively new term.
Mm-hmm. Is trans and transgender, are they interchangeable?
Interchangeable,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So the word transgender was first coined probably in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It did not appear in any academic writings until about 1965. in a book where a therapist or a psychologist is writing about sexual disorders, and is talking about those individuals who are transvestite.
But that's not necessarily transgender,
no.
Is it?
No, yeah. but then that's... Yeah. So when he uses the word transgender, it's to bring some clarification to another term that was coined at about that time, which is transsexual.
Yes.
Okay, now transsexual has a much more clinical interpretation, which is a transsexual is someone who wants to undergo medical, in other words, hormone therapy, and surgical transition, mm-hmm. in order to bring their body into alignment with how they identify internally. And because they're employing medicine and surgery, then it's a very clinical term. And so transsexual was sort of, people who were transsexual were those individuals who mm-hmm. weren't just happy wearing the clothes of the opposite sex. It had nothing to do with sexual gratification, which was what a transvestite was classically understood to be, was someone who dresses in the clothes of the opposite sex for sexual gratification. So these individuals who were classified as transsexual were individuals who it was beyond the need to dress for sexual gratification. It was a personal identity.
And that's the key, isn't it? It's about identity.
A personal identity. Yeah. But then we're wanting to take advantage of advances in medicine and in surgery, because plastic surgery, again, is relatively new and an available tool to doctors, and to be able to transform genitalia to conform more to the anatomy of the sex that you identify, mm-hmm. it was in its infancy. Now, this writer in 1965 says that if a person has needs or desires beyond just simply dressing in the clothes of the opposite sex, then they would be a transsexual. But then he says, more correctly, it should be transgender, because it has nothing to do with sexuality. It has nothing to do with sexual behavior. Mm-hmm. That's the first time that the word transgender appears in an academic book.
To be transsexual, transgender at that time must have been a very, very lonely experience.
But it was still under the lens of homosexuality.
But it's not.
But it was all conflated. It was all part of that lens. Uh-huh. So then, move forward. This is 1966. So things are progressing. More and more individuals are undergoing this transformation. Uh-huh. And you get to about the 1980s. And these protocols that were developed by Harry Benjamin had some very strict guidelines. There was a lot of gatekeeping. So a therapist who might be working with someone who is transsexual would be categorizing the person on all kinds of attributes. Physicality, mm-hmm. will they make convincing women?
Are determining factors as to whether or not you could move forward with treatment?
Yes, because they wanted, the idea then was the therapist was going to help you get from box A to box B as effectively and realistically as possible, or from box B to box A. And if they felt that there were things, handicaps, to you achieving that real presence, uh-huh. Feminine presence or masculine presence, then they would say, no, you don't qualify for this.
So how horrible that must
be. So a lot of individuals not only could not afford the process, but knew that they would be disqualified. So what about them? So the term transgender starts to be used in those early days of modem connection with AOL and CompuServe, mm-hmm. and there are groups that are forming, chat groups that are forming, where people are talking and somebody begins to use the word transgender as, this is who we are. We're not transsexual because we don't meet those requirements. Mm-hmm. And we can't afford to meet those requirements anyway. So I'm transgender because it has nothing to do with sex, and it has everything to do with how I feel inside. So it's not until the late 80s that the word transgender comes into, in a sense, the public discourse. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time I heard the word transgender. I was almost 40 before I heard the word transgender. And up to that point, I didn't know why I felt the way I did. So there was this vacuum of information. And suddenly let's say 1990, now we have the word transgender. And now people are talking. It says, yeah, that's what I am, because I'm not a transvestite. Mm-hmm. I'm not a transsexual because I can't afford surgery. And so it was the word transsexual has always had that finality, that final destination, that you are someone who has modified your body to conform to how you identify.
But that's not necessarily the case with being transgender.
No. So the word transgender has, over time, become more of an umbrella term to incorporate or to include all those individuals who don't feel comfortable identifying fully as male or fully as female, may feel more like the other gender mm-hmm. or sex. Okay, so the other word or the other term is gender dysphoria. And so gender dysphoria means that you experience distress and discomfort and sadness about your gender.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a spectrum in terms, some people have, just like many other spectrums.
So as somebody who lives outside of that experience, because it's not my experience, but I want to understand, how do I ignite a conversation that says, I'm open to understanding, in a world where people who are, you know, on that journey are going to be highly guarded? How do I find common ground?
Okay. Well, the starting point, obviously, is to have that inclination
yeah.
that you want to know.
Right.
Because if you don't want to know and you say, that's a bunch of bullshit, pardon my language, and that's crazy.
Of course, the gate comes down
yeah,
and the conversation.
These people,
and yeah.
So the first step is that inclination. You need
yeah.
to say, okay, I'll be honest. I don't understand it, but I want to be respectful.
Yeah.
So I sincerely want to be respectful. Help me understand. I was so happy when I sent out my coming out letter to many of my friends and clients. Some of them asked that very genuine question. They said, wow, I don't know anything about this. I'm going to learn so much. And can you point me to resources, things that I can read, because I want to know how to support you.
Mm-hmm.
That was answer to prayer. Because I, you know what kept me from doing anything about this until I was 56?
56?
Yes. I was 56 when I finally made the decision, I'm going to accept what the doctors at the Vancouver General Hospital Gender Clinic offered me in 1999, 7 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd gone for assessment. And it had taken me 9 years to get there, because in 1990, when the word transgender is now available to me, I went to see a psychiatrist for the first time, and I had 3 sessions with the guy. And he was very honest. He said, you know, this is not something I understand or really know a lot of. I've spoken to other individuals who, like yourself, struggle with their gender identity. But there's a new clinic that opened up at Vancouver General Hospital. I'd like to refer you to them because they're the experts.
Mm-hmm.
They're working with people like yourself. And I remember thinking, the way I had survived all these years was by embracing a very fundamentalist, evangelical form of Christianity that saw this as an abomination, as something that needed to be fixed, that God was had the power to do that. And I was, for 40 years, crying out to him, please make me normal. I want this to go away for the sake of my family, because I was married and had 3 sons, for the sake of my parents, for the sake of my career, for the sake of not having to ever, you know, have to tell anyone that I struggle with this very secret thing that I've always struggled since I was a little kid with, this very confusing stuff for which I had no language. So in 1990, my psychiatrist said, I'd like to refer you. I said, no, there's no way. 9 years later, I got myself referred to the gender clinic. Because
it took you that long to feel comfortable with getting...
I wasn't comfortable, because I figured, this is how I was thinking. 9 years have gone by. They've done more research. They now must have a way to fix this, to make it go away. So let's call the
gender... That was your thinking.
That was my thinking. Let's call the gender clinic and see how they can fix this and make it go away. So I go through 6 months of assessment. I become educated in terms of how it all works. And when I get the diagnosis that I have acute gender dysphoria, I said, so how do I make it go away? No, it doesn't go away, but we can help you. Here are some of the things that individuals have done.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't like, this is what you have to do. This is what people have done. And these are your options. These are hard decisions to make. You're a married person with children. You're self-employed. We can't make those decisions for you.
Uh-huh.
You need to sit down with your wife and make these decisions, but we're here. And I remember saying to the psychiatrist, saying, I can't do this. I can't pay that price. I just want this to go away. Thanks for your help. Goodbye. And I walked out of that place thinking, I guess I'll take this to my grave, and because I can't do this. And by 2006, I was in a real dark place. I was thinking about dying all the time. I wanted to die.
Because you wanted it to go away.
I wanted it to go away, and it hadn't gone away. God, why haven't you made this go away? I hadn't been able to reconcile my faith to what the doctors had told me, because in the back of my mind, as this very evangelical Christian, I put things in two different boxes, man's wisdom, mm-hmm. God's wisdom, and they don't always go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So whose wisdom am I going to pay attention to? And so I was not able to reconcile what the doctors told me, which was man's wisdom, with what I read in the Bible with respect to creation. Mm-hmm. And that was my struggle. And lo and behold, it took a new pastor to come to our church. It was an evangelical church here in Vancouver. And in his very first sermon, he held up his Bible and he said, many people look at this book and they say, this has all the answers we need to live. And he said, I'm not one of those persons. This book does not contain all the answers to the human condition. There's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of ambiguity. There are a lot of contradictions. And to say otherwise would be a lie. However, I value what the scriptures say, and I approach this book with a lot of humility. And I have learned that it's really dangerous to extract a few phrases from here and there from which to develop a theology or a dogma. And I will never do that. Things are not black and white.
So, does this then give you permission? Yourself, you give yourself permission.
I think that's
to
a good word.
Forward?
I think that's the right word. I think after I began to meditate on this and look at the passage and then read the story of the Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, where there's inclusion, the early church was really characterized by inclusion of those who had been excluded from the economy of the king, of God's economy. Mm-hmm. And so that's what finally, yes, it gave me that sense of permission that, oh my God, there's nothing wrong with me.
This ignites 10,000 other questions that I have. You're married. You have children. How do you broach that subject with them? What happens with those relationships? And then how do you start to share what you're about to do with others?
So one of the statements I made, laments that I made to the psychiatrist at the gender clinic was, you know, I think it'll be just easier if I die and go away. And he said, why do you say that? I said, because it's going to be disruptive and potentially destructive to my wife, to my marriage, it's going to devastate my sons, it's going to devastate my parents, my career is going to implode. I think it's better if I just go away. And he said, okay, how many people know you? I said, well, I don't know. He said, okay, I've learned that you taught at Capilano College. How many students did you teach over the years? I said, let's say 300. Okay, your family owned a restaurant. How many people did you know through the restaurant, staff and customers? Okay, I don't know. That could be 500. Mm-hmm. Churches. You've been attending several churches in Vancouver over the years. How many people got to know you? Okay, another 500. So right there you have over 1,000 people who know who you are, who knows who Jim Salazar is. And I said, okay. I had never really thought about that. And he said, okay. Now, if it were possible, if it were possible for me to ask every single one of them, would you rather have Jim live the rest of his life as a woman or for him not to be here? Which would you prefer?
Right.
And he said, I guarantee you that every single person would say, I'd rather that they be here as a woman than not to be here. And so he said, just think about that. And I think that was the antidote that I needed, because that kept me from, in the years that followed after that, from doing something stupid.
Are you at peace now?
Yes, yes,
yeah.
Very much so.
but has life presented you with other challenges that, you know, we still live in a world where there are people who are going to go, I don't understand. And so does that create another set of challenges for you?
Absolutely. And for example, my career as a self-employed graphic designer, all my clients without exception were incredibly supportive when I sent out the letter or when I read it to them in person. Mm-hmm. They all said the things I needed to hear. This makes no difference. You're an amazingly talented person. It's business is business. As long as you're doing the work, as long as we're happy with things, we're going to keep using you. It makes no difference. The reality is, however, so in the last 4 years, I've sent out 400 resumes. I've had 2 interviews. Nothing's happened. So my conclusion is, great place to live, safe place to live, but we're still seen through a very narrow lens. And people are still uncomfortable.
And you haven't been able to rebuild your own business, your own client base.
So I went back to school and did a master's degree in public and pastoral leadership. I was always very spiritual, very interested in theology. And my hope was to train as a chaplain so that I could offer spiritual support to the trans community, which is, by default I started doing anyway. So right now, I'm still doing that training through Vancouver Coastal Health in a pilot project in downtown Eastside. It's called Clinical Pastoral Education, CPE unit. I'm part of a team of 6 people. And we're there engaging with the community members. So that's, my life has gone in a totally different trajectory. My only income today is my CPP and old age security because I have no graphic design work.
It's a tough journey to be on, but as you say, you're much more at peace.
And I'm alive.
And you're alive.
Yeah.
Well, thank you ever so much, Lisa Salazar, for sharing your story, and hopefully giving others the strength to find their own inner peace.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.